It's the confluence where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. Governor Wolf's final budget for this term calls for a $1 billion increase in spending, no hikes to the income or sales taxes, but it does count on revenue from a Marcellus shale tax, which has not made much headway in the past. Will this election year budget be as contentious as the last 3 years? That's coming up later in the program. But first, teachers, paraprofessionals, and technical, clerical employees in Pittsburgh public schools are mulling over whether they want to strike. It would be their first full picket line in more than 40 years. In studio with us to discuss what's at the heart of this dispute and its potential impact on students and their families are Rebecca Addison. She's news editor with Pittsburgh City Paper, and Sarah Schneider, WESA's education reporter. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
All right, let's start off with an update on the situation. The union, the Pittsburgh Federation of Teachers, sent out ballots to their members last week. What are they asking? How long do PPS employees have to decide? We'll start with you, Rebecca.
So, yes, last week the teachers union did send out ballots, and they're anticipating that between then and now the teachers will have about a week and a half to decide, and they're anticipating that those ballots will be counted on February 12th. Right now, some of the sticking points in the contract negotiations have to do with health care. One of the things that I've heard is that teacher scheduling has especially been an issue, but there are also problems that they're having trouble agreeing on, things like contract lengths and salaries as well.
Okay, I want to get some of those details as well. Sarah, you spoke with union president Nina Esposito-Vizgaitis. She didn't seem too pessimistic.
We are hoping that we will be able to continue talking and come up with a resolution before even the strike ballots are back. That would make me very happy.
Sarah?
Yeah, so both parties have said they want to continue negotiating. They have not met since those ballots were sent out. They are scheduled to meet February 16th, and that is with the state mediator. They've been meeting with the state mediator since the fact finder report came out, and that was in November when both parties voted on that. Of course, the teachers union rejected that, which has led to, you know, second round of negotiation and where we're at now.
Rebecca.
So one of the things that I've also heard is that even if the ballots are counted on February 12th and they do show that they're in favor of a strike, that doesn't automatically mean that they will strike. So even if more people vote for a strike, it doesn't mean, you know, next week that we'll see a strike.
So in other words, the teachers don't have the automatic say. It's up to a committee?
It gives the union, the board, the authority to call a strike, but they would have to give the district 48 hours notice before that would happen, before teachers walked out.
Okay. In a statement, the district said negotiations will continue in order to avoid a walkout. Have we heard anything else from district officials? Even Anthony Hamlet, the superintendent, maybe.
They're trying to keep it at the bargaining table between the union and the district. The district has been pretty quiet on what's holding up the process right now, just trying to avoid a strike.
They've been tight-lipped with you as well, Rebecca?
Yeah, I'd say other than a statement that the district sent out, I believe it was last week, there haven't been very many insights from the district about how negotiations are going. The statement just by Superintendent Hamlet just basically said that they're committed to continuing to work with them.
I will say in November when they voted on the fact finder's report, which, you know, talked about the issues and where both parties stood at the time, when the board voted on that and they did approve that report, Hamlet at that time said that they were closer together than they were apart in negotiations. But since then, we haven't heard a whole lot.
So what really are they arguing about? And is there one that's maybe even more at the heart of the disagreement than another? Do we know?
Yeah, Rebecca talked about the teacher scheduling. That's a huge thing right
now. More so than the financial?
It's hard to say. Okay. It's hard to say because we're not getting a lot of detail right now. But that was in the fact finder's report. There was a very extensive explanation of what the issue was, and that the district wants to give more authority to principals when determining schedules for the year. Right now, a lot the teachers can kind of override what the principal decides as far as their preference for what they're teaching. And it seems like the district might want to give more of that authority to the leaders of the schools.
Well, a reminder to our listeners, you can find that Fact Finder report on our website, WESA.FM. So, Rebecca, let's get a little more to the financial, because it always, most strikes or potential strikes, labor disputes, at least have some element of finances, whether it's payment or benefits or whatever. Those are still issues to be resolved as well, you've found out?
Yeah, I believe so.
And is it the typical pay and health benefits? I mean, they always seem to arise.
Yeah, healthcare is an issue. The union has said that the district wants to put more of the burden on teachers for different things. So yeah, things that we see in a lot of labor disputes, as well as salary. The union wants increases, a different schedule for pay raises, things like that. So those are pretty typical sticking points.
You mentioned schedule, and Rebecca, you brought up the scheduling of teachers a little bit earlier. Let's get into this. What exactly are we talking about, the scheduling of teachers? Is it what schools they are at, or their day, their typical class day?
So I know that teacher placement has been a problem in the past, where teachers have certain schools that they prefer to be at, but sometimes seniority, experience, the subjects that they specialize in can determine where they're placed, and they don't have as much control over it. And I believe that's something that the teachers union says the teachers should have more control over.
Yeah, there's a voluntary transfer process right now, and that's part of the issue of when teachers would be able to switch schools. Is it seniority? But then other groups, advocacy groups, are saying that that pulls good teachers from schools that need good teachers.
Mm-hmm. And as far as the individual class day for basically the work schedule on any given day for a teacher, is there concern? Again, we're not hearing a whole lot that they're overworked. They're trying to get them to teach more classes. Are we hearing anything about that?
I'm sure that's an issue. Teachers are always overworked, but that's not something that the union has talked a whole lot about. It's this preference of what you're teaching and what you prefer to teach.
Okay. All right. So that long stretch of negotiations that we talked about, talks on and off for about 18 months, about a year and a half, still no agreement. It was reported by the Post-Gazette that Mayor Peduto offered to mediate the dispute, but the district rebuffed that suggestion, saying there are state-appointed mediators to handle that job when necessary. The school district solicitor, Ira Weiss, responded. So what's Weiss's point in this letter to the editor?
So I guess the mayor in conversations about the ongoing battle between the district and the union was kind of saying that the school board is just like any other board or authority. And one of Weiss's points was that actually they're not just like any other board or authority. They're actually elected in the same way that a mayor is elected, and where a mayor does appoint members to a board or an authority like the PWSA, for instance, these members on the school board are elected officials. So the mayor's comments, you know, were kind of off base, is what he was saying.
And longtime residents of the city will remember that the Pittsburgh School Board had been appointed by the mayor. So what did you get from Ira Weiss's letter, Sarah?
Yeah, he was just saying, you know, his advice for the superintendent was to keep bargaining between the union and the district. And so he was basically, his takeaway was, his advice to the mayor was to offer that same respect that other public officials would expect.
Negotiations began shortly after Anthony Hamlet became superintendent. Is there any sense that his appointment has affected the talks in any way? We have a new leader of the school district. Is there any sense of his impact on the actual negotiations?
So I did ask Nina Esposito-Vizcaitis, the president of the teachers union, if she sensed any change between this administration and previous administrations. And she said that was hard to say, but that some issues were coming up that haven't come up in the past. And she was alluding to this teacher scheduling issue. So that's what I've heard.
Rebecca?
I really haven't heard much about how he has influenced the negotiations. I know that obviously, you know, many people will remember that his selection as superintendent was very contentious. And so It's possible that some of the things he brings to the table might differ from what was discussed previously.
Okay. Students, no matter what school district they attend, they're always impacted by a strike, whether it's making up the lost school days at the end of the regularly scheduled school year. But a strike in Pittsburgh public schools, that can disrupt more than just the school day. And you've both reported on this, sort of the ripple effect of canceling classes due to a strike.
Yeah, I mean, so in Pittsburgh public schools, 65% of students are eligible for free and reduced lunch or reduced lunch. And that's often an indicator of the level of economic disadvantage in our schools. And so families and students rely on the school day for meals, sometimes two meals, and then after school care or programming. So A-Plus is, yeah, putting together some kind of plan to help fill that gap if students can't be in the buildings.
For our listeners who aren't sure, what's the main mission, the goal, just briefly, of what A-Plus does?
So A-Plus is kind of a education watchdog group. I feel like they try to fill the gaps that exist in our current education system by serving as a resource for parents who want to get maybe more involved in education. They also serve as kind of a go-between between the district and the foundation community and the nonprofit communities.
All right. I mentioned you both talked to James Fogarty, head of A-Plus Schools. This is what he told WESA.
Organizations will be ready to take those kids if it were to happen, and that we would have something for the kids to do and food for them to eat.
We're talking potentially about thousands of kids. A lot of logistical challenges here. Sarah, Rebecca, how can that organization and others step in if a strike were to occur? Are they still working that out?
So they are still working that out. They're looking at examples of other school districts and what they've done in the past. One of the districts, I believe, that has some experience in this is a Chicago school district where their nonprofit community stepped up and they were able to serve, I believe, something in the area of 60,000 students when their teachers went on strike. I did an analysis of how much this could cost, and apparently the cost of providing care for every student in the district, if every student would need care, would be in the range of $1.5 million.
How's that calculated, briefly?
So this is based on numbers from 2017 data from the organization Child Care Aware of America. They did a calculation, or they do a yearly calculation, actually, of child care costs across the country. And this was based on the average cost for child care every day in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm. But where these kids would go as well during the day and even for the making up for the after school programs as well, Sarah?
Yeah, if you have parents that are working hourly jobs, it's very difficult to take off time to be with your kids. So A-Plus is reaching out to groups like the Boys and Girls Club or the Park Services, places that there's already programming in place and they're just asking to expand.
Yeah, so the great thing about Pittsburgh is that we do have all these foundations and all of these nonprofits that could step up and help in the event of a strike.
Yeah, I mean, they haven't pulled together a plan like this before. When there was the last strike authorization vote was in 2007, and they did avoid a strike at that point, and A-Plus kind of was hands-off. They were more lobbying for both groups to try to avoid a strike, so this wasn't part of the plan. But so now it's happening and they haven't done it before. And like Rebecca said, they've been looking at Chicago and what they've done. So I know James said that he was meeting with groups this week to try to figure out what to do because the vote is going to be counted on Monday.
Is he giving you any hint that this is doable?
So I think they're looking at it as it must be done. When I talked to him, they hadn't done too much work. I think they were looking for the district to maybe take the lead and kind of give them the go-ahead, essentially, to say, you know, yes, put this together, because they wanted the district. They sent out a statement last week saying that the district needed to have a plan in place before the strike happens.
Okay. So no strike yet. Again, the ballots are scheduled to be counted on Monday.
Monday
the 12th. And again, that doesn't mean automatic strike. Mm-hmm. That is up to the union board.
Right.
Any idea when a decision will be made by that board after they get the votes one way or another?
The union is meeting with the district on the 16th, but that is also after the PFT's executive board meeting. So a decision could be made then before they meet with the district again.
And they have to provide notice?
48 hours.
So in summing up what you have heard, could we have our first strike since 1975?
Seems like everyone's taking it pretty seriously, trying to make a plan and figure out what would happen if the, you know, there are 2,400 teachers in Pittsburgh and if there are 24,000 students. So there's a plan, going to be a plan for if that happens.
Yeah, I think everyone understands that this is pretty serious, but it's not something that they're going to go into like lightly if we consider that there has not been a strike since, you know, 1975.
Rebecca Addison is news editor for Pittsburgh City Paper. Sarah Schneider is WESA's education reporter. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In addition to the potential teacher strike, Pittsburgh Public Schools officials are eyeing up Governor Wolf's proposed budget for the new fiscal year. It includes additional $100 million for public schools. That's part of the $33 billion budget Wolf outlined this week into the legislature, about a 3% increase over the current fiscal year's total. Joining us from Harrisburg to discuss what's in the budget, what could be hurdles for passing it, Brad Bumstead. He's the bureau chief for the Caucus, a weekly newspaper by LNP Media Group covering government and politics. Hello, Brad.
How are you doing?
I am well, Brad. So the governor gave his budget address Tuesday. What did you hear? What were his big priorities?
Well, $1 billion spending increase, which the Republicans criticize, and a Marcellus Shale tax, a severance tax on natural gas, which he's wanted from the first day he entered office. So those are things that are really important to the governor.
All right, you know,
this is an election year budget. There's not likely to be anything near the amount of consternation that there was in the first 3 years of this budget when he had major tax increases in there, sales tax, income tax. There's none of that in here that we know of anyway. It's the Marcellus Shale tax on natural gas. That's a real hurdle. It has been. Speaker of the House Mike Terzai, a suburban Pittsburgh Republican from the North Hills, wants no part of that. He's played a major role in blocking it. He's also running for governor.
Yeah. Did the sharpest criticism come from a couple of members of the legislature, Republican members, who hope to knock off Wolf in November?
Yes. I think that, you know, Senator Scott Wagner, another Republican who's running for governor, and Mike Terzai were very vocal critics of this. So were a lot of other Republicans where this is directed. But because of the election year, because so many people are running, including all of the House, half the Senate, congressional seats are up. It's a midterm election, meaning that favors the Democrats. That usually favors the party out of power, which is the Democrats in this case because of Trump being in the White House. They want to get done. They don't want something lingering, you know, beyond too much, at least beyond the July 1st deadline. Wolf's first year, there was no budget passed the entire year. It went into the following year before they finally patched together a budget. But,
right,
you know, guaranteed they won't raise taxes. And number two, they'll want to get done quickly so they can go campaign.
I mentioned to the governor, I talked to him this week, and he said he doesn't expect this one to be as contentious as the first three, especially this current year's budget and the very first one. Is he being overly optimistic?
No, he's not. I think that is the general take on this whole budget. That's not just him. The Republicans would be less likely to concede that, but in their heart of hearts, they know they don't want to be here in September still, you know, fighting over the budget. Because you could say, well, wouldn't it do them good to be, you know, out at the last minute still fighting over a Marcellus Shale tax or whatever, maybe a little bit in a primary, but not in a general election, whoever the Republican nominee is, because, you know, people blame everybody when the job doesn't get done. Now, that's what polls showed pretty much in Wolf's first year, is when the budget didn't get done. It was a fiasco. Nonprofit organizations weren't getting funding. They blamed everybody. The voters, that is.
Right. You mentioned Marcellus Shale tax. He's counting on, I believe, $250 million from the Marcellus Shale tax. With the Republican reaction to this, even though it got a little traction last year, so that $33 billion looks like it might have to be reduced because if the Republicans don't accept the shale tax.
Well, that's very perceptive. I mean, it's going to fall short because of that. And whether it's $250 million is another issue. It's not clear to me that it would even bring in that much, which is what they're talking about. So, but in any case, they will be short there. But, you know, as they're very prone to do and capable of doing, they can shift things around and, you know, borrow from certain funds and put them in other funds and put the P under the thimble. And before you know it, they've got a, quote, balanced, unquote, budget. And it never has been over the past, you know, 6, 7, 8 years. It's been a deficit budget in the sense that it's carried over to the following year. A structural deficit is what they call it.
So final quick question. Will Pennsylvania have a new budget in place for the new fiscal year, July 1?
I would predict no, not by July 1, but by the nation's birthday on the 4th.
All right.
Just that it may go over a little bit, you know, and they don't.
Brad Bumstead is the bureau chief for the Caucus, a weekly newspaper by LNP Media Group covering government and politics. Thanks so much, Brad.
Thank you for having me on.
Coming up, why does Pennsylvania have so many untested rape kits? How does that impact victims? That's next on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. Pennsylvania's attorney general is one of several across the country opposing a federal plan that would allow employers to control the tips of employees who make minimum wage. And today marks the deadline for state lawmakers to submit a new congressional map to Governor Tom Wolf. However, leaders of the GOP-controlled state legislature say they won't finish by today's deadline. The original map was deemed an unconstitutional gerrymander that favored Republicans. Find more at WESA.FM.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Since 2016, roughly 700 backlogged rape kits have been tested in Pennsylvania, but the remaining number hovers around 1,200, with some untested kits dating back to the 1990s. We're going to talk about the reasons for this backlog, and also how that impacts law enforcement and especially victims. Joining us in studio is Natasha Lindstrom, reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune-Review, and WESA reporter Kathleen Davis. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And your input is welcome as well, and you can tweet us using the hashtag WESAConfluence. So to try to understand why there's a backlog, let's talk a little bit about the process. When evidence is gathered, what's the next step?
So under this new act that was passed in 2015 called Act 27 in the state of Pennsylvania, this established a timetable for law enforcement to collect kits and send them out for testing. And often in Allegheny County, the Office of the Medical Examiner reported a turnaround time of at least 6 months for processing rape kits, and they are one of three major public crime labs in the state. And there are only three, yes. And at the Allegheny County one, there are only 9 people who are able to process the evidence, and that number has not grown since the passage of Act 27, which ended up giving an influx of kits to these labs.
So, Natasha, do we have a sense of why there is the backlog? Why has they just sort of been piling up year after year?
So, backlogs can fluctuate at any given point in time. And when talking to some of the people who work in the forensic biology office at the Allegheny Chief Medical Examiner's Office, they tell me that, they're I think about maybe a year ago or a little more, they'd gotten the backlog down to zero. Right now, it's about 209 untested cases, And backlog can differentiate depending whether you classify that as 30 days being in backlog or over a year, et cetera. But there's several reasons. For one thing, when it comes down to predominantly is staffing and resources, in addition to having only so many people on staff, as was mentioned, it can take about over 2 years to get properly trained and certified to do the sophisticated level of testing that needs to happen. So a lot of turnovers they've been having in the office, that can delay things. They also, because of the strapped resources, they deprioritize cases that are active, that are prosecutors are actively seeking charges against, et cetera. And there are limited numbers of testing they can do. They have to balance this with backlogs and across other categories of crimes, such as homicides, drugs, et cetera.
So these labs aren't just testing for crimes of rape?
Correct.
Okay. And Natasha, you said one's in Allegheny County. The other two are?
One of them is in Philadelphia, and I'm not exactly sure where the third one is.
The third one is in Greensburg. It's this run by the Pennsylvania State Police. So anything that happens in statewide, really, but as well as southwestern Pennsylvania, outside of Allegheny County, will go to the Greensburg Crime Lab.
Okay. You mentioned staffing and the extensive training that has to be done. Do we have a sense that the facilities in themselves can handle more work and it's just the number of workers, trained workers, or are they operating at capacity and maybe more labs are needed? Do we have an idea?
At least in Allegheny County, I actually had the opportunity to visit it this morning and meet with the chief medical examiner there, Dr. Carl Williams. And they tell me they are staffing is one of the biggest issues and funding. But there is also some technology they'd like to invest in and training and to kind of keep up with the latest best practices. You know, they showed me one machine that they have operating. It's about $125,000. There are two other ones that are out of service now because they don't quite meet the latest standards. So equipment can be an issue, but it's not necessarily needing to build a whole new lab. I think the existing labs could do more with more resources.
Pennsylvania is not the only state struggling to reduce a backlog of untested rape kits. Virginia's been dealing with its own issue. And let's welcome into the conversation for just a couple of minutes reporter Antonio Olivo from The Washington Post. Antonio, thanks so much for spending a couple of minutes with us.
Happy to be here.
Bad is the backlog in Virginia? How far back do they go?
Back about a year ago, there were roughly 3,000 rape kits that had not been tested, and some of them were dated back 25 years. Since then, the state has sought to expedite the process and has applied for some federal grant money that has made it easier, and there's a law that was signed by Governor McAuliffe that basically requires the kits to be kept for 2 years if somebody does not press charges, and that if somebody does report a rape, that the evidence be sent to analysis within 2 months. So it's cut into that backlog pretty substantially. I think they're down to basically half the amount, or maybe even more at this point. They were down to half that amount as of last fall.
Mm-hmm. What's at the heart of the problem? Does it all come down to money and facilities and workers?
It does come down to money and workers, as in other states. But there's also a cultural competence issue, I think, in some areas where there are growing immigrant populations of women who aren't comfortable speaking English, or people in a local police department who don't understand what is being said, or there just may be sort of a more psychological barriers that are involved. And so that has also contributed to the backlog in some parts of Virginia, mainly within Virginia. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned the governor of Virginia signing a law last year. My final question to you, so what is Virginia, what's their approach to fixing this problem?
Well, as I said, they applied for some federal grant money recently that allowed the state to essentially transfer that money to some local police departments and hired people who would analyze these records. And so that is what is happening on the ground at this point. And you know, I mean, the law that was signed last year that essentially requires this the kids to be processed within 2 months, that has had a huge effect as well, because I did part of the problem with respect to the delays also was sort of an attitudinal problem in some local police departments where, you know, police officers didn't believe the women who were coming forward and reporting the rapes. And so that has, I think, made some difference.
Antonio Olivo is a reporter with The Washington Post. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And remaining in studio with us is Natasha Lindstrom of the Tribune Review and WESA's Kathleen Davis. Auditor General, Pennsylvania Auditor General Eugene DePasquale called attention to Pennsylvania's backlog a couple of years ago. That's not part of his official purview, but it seems to be a matter of personal concern and alarm on his part. The Pennsylvania legislature passed a law in 2015 that Kathleen alluded to a little earlier. Do we know why it hasn't? Has it helped? Why hasn't it helped, or as much as it was intended to do?
So when Act 27 was passed by the General Assembly in 2015, it established timetables for law enforcement to collect kits and send them out for testing to usually one of these three major labs. But it did not provide additional resources for labs to actually test these kits, which ended up overwhelming the labs. So DePasquale actually released a report in 2016 that was a little bit of a follow-up to Act 27's passing in 2015, where he found some data on local police departments across Pennsylvania that showed that a lot of them didn't even know that Act 27 required them to report information about the untested rape kits. So it seems like the passage almost was a little more confusing than that.
Okay. So we mentioned earlier that some of these untested kits go back to the 90s. Natasha, is there some sort of criteria? I mean, it's not, you know, the oldest ones get tested first, or what? What's the criteria here?
So the top criteria, I'm told, is active cases, cases that are being prosecuted in court. There are, in Allegheny County at least, they tell me it isn't their case there where they have rape kits sitting on the shelf dating back to the 90s. That is supposedly what's going on with the state police, which is responsible for all the ones statewide. And so I can't speak to some of those cases, but they say in Allegheny County, they don't have any that have been there for more than a year currently. That's after being able to clear the backlog with some help with some federal grants. Now, what's one thing that's interesting to me is that another thing in terms of prioritizing cases, they say historically speaking, if there wasn't charges filed, if a case wasn't pursuing, they might not test a kit. A change that's been happening nationwide is this push, along with this so-called end the backlog movement, is to test all of them that are related to police reports being filed against rapists, because what we're finding, like for instance in Detroit, the testing of 11,000 backlog rape kits since 2009 has led to the identification of 817 serial rapists, people who've raped more than once. And Wayne County Prosecutor Kim Worthy there has said in her experience, often these predators had raped 7 to 11 times before getting caught. And so the new way of thinking is, hey, even if this isn't going to lead to charges in this particular case, it's going to behoove us all to add to this DNA, federal DNA FBI database that really got going in the 90s, so we can help catch these repeat offenders.
Kathleen, you spoke with Kristen Hauser from the Pennsylvania Coalition Against Rape. What's the essence of what she told you?
So one thing that really stuck out to me when we spoke is that obviously a sexual assault is a very traumatic event. And with some of these kits that haven't been processed for years, if this event happened to you, you know, 7 years ago, and then you just get results, say, this past month or something, that can bring up a lot of old wounds. And some victims don't really want to know, or they've moved on. So after that amount of time, so the essence of what she told me was that processing these kits in a timely fashion is one of the most important things that can be done.
Okay, we have 1 minute left. And so, once again, is it coming down to money? I know the Auditor General has asked the governor and the legislature to increase funding to address this issue quickly. Natasha.
Yes, and Governor Wolf, Tom Wolf, said he has indeed prioritized this issue. He has allocated more funding for DNA technicians at the state police level. However, the likes of the Allegheny office as well as the Philadelphia Crime Lab, they aren't necessarily benefiting from that funding, and they say they would definitely like to see more. One way that Allegheny County has been dealing with a partial solution in the interim is outsourcing some of its cases with funding it's gotten. So it's been able to reduce the cost per test from over $1,000 to about $600 a test. So they're trying to get more taxpayer bang for the buck.
And final thought, Kathleen.
Eugene DePasquale, the Pennsylvania Attorney General, has
Auditor General,
asked for $1.2 million in the state budget to end the backlog, which is a very small
amount
percentage.
When you're talking about a $33 billion dollar budget. All right. Kathleen Davis is a WESA reporter. Natasha Lindstrom is a reporter for Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, when threats of violence, social media, and schools collide, that's next on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, a blizzard dumps more than 2 feet of snow on the region in 2010. Often referred to as Snowmageddon, the storm prompted a state of emergency declaration, and local authorities asked non-essential vehicles to stay off the road. Some took advantage of the weather and went sledding on downtown streets and skiing on Mount Washington. That's this week's Pittsburgh Almanac for February 9th, 2018.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Threats made against schools are nothing new, whether it was a hand-scrawled note left in a school restroom or an anonymous call, sometimes placed by students hoping to get classes canceled. But now the vehicles for the threats are much more sophisticated. We're going to talk about what schools are doing to address the threats made via social media with Pittsburgh Post-Gazette reporter Julian Routh. Welcome back to the show, Julian.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
All right. Tell us about the specific threat that sort of started your reporting, if you'll briefly recap that.
Sure. I actually looked at two threats in the month of January. One that happened toward Montour High School.
That MHS.
The MHS threat, which was against about nine schools over a period of a couple of days. Montour was the only one that appeared to fall for the hoax and cancel schools that day. And then I looked at a threat in late January, which put Pittsburgh public schools on modified lockdown. This was a threat that originated in a online video game chat room in the state of Florida that was able to close schools, put them on modified lockdown in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
And this was a grown man in Florida issuing this threat. So 1,200 miles away.
Correct. And it's, you know, that really exemplifies the changing landscape. So what I set out to do was find how schools can react to this new digital world where instead of going outside and seeing a student on a payphone making a threat, you're getting threats across state lines. So, you know, a couple of things that the sources that I talked to said could happen would be creating threat assessment teams to be in the schools to analyze social media and also putting resources into mental health.
Right. So that's what I was going to get to is what's the attitude among schools now? I mean, when figuring out how to address these threats, even the suggestion of violence, especially in the last 20 years since the mass shooting at Columbine, they have to take them seriously.
They do. And that's the thing is there's no playbook for this. And they're deciding the playbook as it goes, which is why you're seeing some varied results, whether it's Montour High School closing. You know, it's like, you know, you don't want to be the school to not take the threat seriously because it came online and then something, God forbid, happens. But something that my sources kept reminding me, especially in the school districts, was schools are very, very safe places to be still. Though there are several dozen terroristic threats per year, the only act of attempted murder or violence in region schools was Franklin Regional in 2014.
Right.
So relatively safe.
All right. In your reporting, what have you learned about the number of threats locally? Are they increasing, dropping, what?
It looks like the number of threats are increasing gradually over time, and a lot of my sources credit that to the availability of social media in making these threats. Now, in 2016, 2017, There was 45 terroristic threats and 9 bomb threats in area schools. Now, another study says that about 37% of analyzed threats come electronically. So that's the trend that's changing over time.
You mentioned, we're running out of time, but you mentioned that there's no playbook. So do they know what to do when they receive a threat? Is there sort of a best policy to follow?
The best policy that everybody is telling me to follow is to think cognitively when you get one instead of thinking emotionally. And that goes to my two examples that we had, one thought cognitively, one thought emotionally before reacting.
All right, but sometimes that reaction time needs to be sped up if there's a specific timetable to that threat, though.
Right, and you have investigations taking longer as well into these threats because they're coming across state lines. So it's a very, very difficult process and a lot of hoping, a lot of guessing. That's not something that you like to see as a student or a parent, but it's something that they're figuring out over time.
And of course, this threat that came out of Florida, if you would, Pittsburgh Public Schools, but city schools, they're not the, and Pittsburgh Public Schools, not the only district facing this.
No, it's all over the country right now. Everybody's facing it, and it's something that not everybody knows what to do about.
Julian Routh is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Julian, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Schools also occasionally have to deal with physical violence from within, especially at sporting events where passions run high, sometimes among student athletes, their parents, even fans. The latest example came Tuesday night at a boys' basketball game between Manessa and Clairton at Clairton High School. In the fourth quarter, a player from each team exchanged punches. Dozens of fans came onto the court, creating a free-for-all. In studio, we welcome Kevin Gorman, sports columnist for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Welcome to the program, Kevin. Good to talk to you.
You too. Thanks for having me, Kevin.
Now, Kevin, you covered in the past high school sports for years. Really, how common are fights in sporting events, high school sporting events?
I don't think fights between players are all that uncommon, but usually it's limited to a one or two punches thrown and before it's broken up. In fact, when I played high school basketball back in the late 80s, early 90s, we'd been in fights with several of our rival schools that we played against. I was at Baldwin High School. We had fights with Bethel Park when I was a freshman, with Mount Lebanon, with Upper St. Clair. Some of them were worse than others. But I think the biggest problem was when you have fans and parents coming onto the floor and the players not fighting amongst themselves, but fighting with fans. And I think that's what really makes this one a different issue. And it'll be interesting to see how the WPIL reacts to this. I think they're waiting to see how the schools discipline themselves.
Right. So I believe there's a hearing Monday
Before the WPIL Board of Directors. And but the schools also have games tonight, their final section playoff games before the playoffs. And I think it's a matter of being a little more punitive. If the schools take the action, I think the WPIL will accept it if they think that they're punishing themselves harshly enough. But if not, they could be really subject to much harsher penalties if it's not self-imposed.
Right. As parents and fans, even as Pittsburghers, we love our sports, and we're passionate about our high school teams. I mean, I love the WPIL high school basketball tournament, but why does that passion sometimes turn into violence on the court or maybe even on the field?
Well, you have to understand about these two schools in particular, Clairton and Manessen, have a rivalry that it crosses different sports lines. I mean, it's a football rivalry. Clairton had a 66-game winning streak in football that was the state's longest. It started against Manessen, and it ended with Manessen. Manessen was the first team to beat them. So there's a rivalry there that started with football, and it's crossed over into basketball. So these are two small, very sports-proud communities, very small, hanging on to their school districts. And there's a lot of negative things that going on. A lot of the positives happen with, you know, a lot of the pride in those communities is related to the school. So I think there's that. There's a fierce rivalry here. And there was, you know, from my understanding, and it's very brief in that sense, there was some bad blood between maybe some of the players on these teams and maybe even some of the fans and some of the players. So, you know, you're talking about some players that may not – they may be football players that are at the basketball game or just recent graduates of schools that got involved as well. So, you know, some of that is carried on, and the problem is that it carried over onto the floor. Fans have no business. Once you pay, you're a paying customer, you're paying for a seat in the stands, you have no business being on the floor, and that's where both schools cross the line.
Oh. What about where the games are played? And I don't mean necessarily the community. Do the closer confines, like you might experience in some smaller basketball gyms,
and Clarence is a bandbox,
play a role as opposed to larger fields where stands are farther away from the playing field?
I think that's the biggest problem in this case. Is that the Manesson fans were right behind the Manesson bench. This fight happened in front of the Manesson bench. And so the fans all of a sudden swarmed a Clareton player, which caused the Clareton fans to jump out of their seats. But fights between two players can be broken up quickly, whether it's the coaches or the officials intervening. The problem was that the fans came on the stands, and once one fan came on, it was swarms of them. And then fights broke out all over the gymnasium from the two videos that I've watched.
Mm-hmm. The WPIAL director has weighed in. What's the league's stance at this point? Or is it they're waiting till that hearing on Monday?
Well, I talked to Tribune Review High School's writer Chris Harlan on my way in, and he was saying that, you know, Tim O'Malley, the WPL executive director, would prefer not to have to ban either one of these teams from the playoffs. He doesn't want to necessarily punish the players for the actions of the fans. But at the same time, I believe Clareton just issued a statement through Twitter that it's going to have only parents and guardians allowed inside their game tonight at Clareton, and they play St. Joseph's from Natrona Heights. Manesson would be wise to do the same thing. And if I'm the WPL, I'm probably taking it a step further and saying, you know, until this is resolved, I'm not sure I'd let any fans in any of their games right now, which could include the playoffs, which would be a real punishment to their opponents. But I think right now you have to take the safeguard measures.
That's not unusual to have basically empty gyms playing before no fans. That's happened before, hasn't it?
No, sure. I mean, in fact, I remember years and years ago, and I think it was around 2000, Penn Hills had a player named Drew Schifino, who is one of the all-time scoring leaders and set the WPL playoffs record for points in a playoff run. He got his 2,000th point in an empty gym against Woodland Hills because there had been an incident between those two schools. So, you know, that's happened before. It's not uncommon. It seems like a drastic measure, but I think, like you're dealing with, I think it's better to be proactive and to prevent something from happening than to have to be reactive and react to something that's already happened, because that's what we're seeing here with these two schools. This is far from an isolated incident. In fact, I was covering a state championship game when Stowe Rocks played in the state basketball finals, and there was a fight on the floor in front of the opposing team's bench. Their entire bench emptied onto the floor, and one of the players' brothers was attacked. His brother was the manager of the team. He was only in eighth grade. And when he jumped out and tried to help his brother, family members came onto the floor. And you know, so people were at the state championship games. It's happened, you know, and the state didn't handle it very well. They should have punished teams much differently than they did. And I think that's the key right here, is to make sure the punishment has to kind of fit the crime, so to speak. And you can't be too severe, but you also can't just give them a slap on the wrist, because whatever the WPL does now sets a precedent for the next time it happens. And you want to try to prevent it from happening again.
Okay. I understand there is at least a local police investigation. Does that happen often, or is it strictly sort of kept in-house within the league?
Well, typically, yeah. I mean, typically you're dealing with it's more just about players being ejected, and under PIAA rules, they're not allowed to play the next game. So I think we might see both of these schools hold some players out as punishment for their involvement. But when you're getting fans involved, and when you're getting fans running onto the floor and hitting a player, sometimes you're dealing with an adult hitting a teenager who's a minor. And so I do think a police investigation is warranted in this incident, because you might be dealing with a crime here.
All right. We have just about 30 seconds left, Kevin. You mentioned the possibility of punishments, what they might be, depending on the outcome of the hearing. Are there any proactive steps that the league could take to avoid future fights?
Well, I think one of the things is you have to be kind of mind your P's and Q's and paying attention to social media and such to make sure that you don't hear any rumblings of this, and preventive measures can be taken. But I think it's also upon the school districts, not the WPL, but the school districts themselves, to make sure they have proper security for the right opponents, and to make sure that if they're in a small gym, that there's enough security separating the fans from the floor so that something like this doesn't happen again. I don't think there was enough security. And I also think, as much as the officials want to stay out of it, blowing a whistle a few times might have helped. That was kind of one of the things when I watched the videos. Why isn't anybody blowing a whistle? Why aren't the adults trying to break this up? And I saw some do it, but not enough.
All right. Kevin Gorman is a sports columnist for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Thanks so much, Kevin.
Thank you.
And for this week, that's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Our engineer is Tom Hurley. Research and production assistance from Zakiya Majan. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good week of good news.